Welcome to God and Country Biblical Exposition. This week's program is the first part in a two-part series covering the book of Ecclesiastes. I'm calling it Ecclesiastes in 50 Minutes. That's two programs, 25 minutes each. And I was considering making it one program, calling it Ecclesiastes in 25 minutes. But given the complications of the book, I wouldn't be doing it justice. Why Ecclesiastes? Well, we often talk about having a Christian worldview, and here it's laid out for us in Ecclesiastes. This book is God's philosophy of life. You know, there is Platonism and Stoicism and Epicureanism and existentialism and communism and many other schools of philosophy today. But in Ecclesiastes, we find God's true philosophy for man. And given its subject, you would think that more people would know Ecclesiastes inside and out. But within fallen man is an intrinsic bias against God and his truth. Now, some Christians have been taught that Ecclesiastes is a godless book written by a spiritually backslidden king. After all, the book begins by saying, "Vanity of vanity, all is vanity." And that doesn't sound like the biblical message of purpose and hope and salvation. It sounds like one of the complaints of the critics. So it's assumed by some that Ecclesiastes is the philosophy of a rebel, the philosophy of man without God. But once you understand Solomon's point, you realize that this book is God's answer to mankind's timeless questions, such as, you know, the question that every philosopher tries to answer: how did we get here? What's the purpose in life? And how's the best way to live? And Ecclesiastes is very relevant today in that it refutes the modern narrative that God and his values are oppression, the narrative put forth by Satan in the garden, and the bitterness and the complaint of the way of Cain. The false teaching that's now being revived and propagated in our nation through the new Gnostic religion of wokeism and queer theory and social Marxism and DEI and critical race theory and racial identity politics is all refuted in the book of Ecclesiastes. And the knowledge of Ecclesiastes will save the Christian from much frustration and anxiety and intellectual pitfalls. It's in our Bibles for a very important reason. It's necessary for Christian maturity and service. It's profitable for teaching, for reproof, for correction, for training in righteousness. 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse 16. And my own personal testimony is that as a college student, Ecclesiastes restored my joy because I began to overthink everything and carried everything to its logical, rational conclusion that given the sovereignty of God and 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 10, that everything is going to go up in flames, why do anything? But Ecclesiastes solves that paradox. Now, we have to start with an outline. There are 5 points in the book. At least that's a good way to divide up the truth. First, the vanity of this fallen world, chapter 1. Second, beginning in chapter 2, God's purpose for creating the vanity. Third, the alleged contradictions to God's good purpose, chapter 4. Fourth, God's answer to the seeming contradictions, chapters 5 through 8. And the fifth point is chapters 8 through 12, how to live in a world that's subject to vanity. The questions asked and the answers given in Ecclesiastes go to the real heart of the problem, not like the philosophies of men, which according to Paul in 1 Corinthians is the foolishness of this world. 1 Corinthians 1:20, where's the wise man? Where's the scribe? Where's the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? So what's the answer? Where are the philosophers of this world? Well, they're all dead. and a lot of good their philosophies did them. And let me also point out, if Ecclesiastes is so relevant, why don't people get it? How come so many people miss it? Or rather, why is it so difficult to apply it to the issues in our day? Well, when I was in graduate school, I took a class in ancient philosophy. And I read Plato and Socrates and Aristotle. And I had no idea what they were talking about because I didn't understand the ancient language that was used to describe the problems. I had not yet experienced enough of life to really understand the issues. For example, when I read Plato's Theory of Forms, it sounded like complete nonsense. Plato wondered if a horse is really a horse or whether there's a form above a horse. And that was the dumbest thing I ever heard. But Plato was actually addressing what was behind all of the political conflict in America today. Are there absolute moral laws given to us by God that are above us, or is there just moral relativism? I mean, is there a God who gives objective, concrete truth above our physical world to which the physical world must conform, or is everything just material? Plato was simply forming the problem in the language and the analogies of his ancient culture. So Ecclesiastes is communicating truth in 3,000-year-old Hebrew culture and language. But once we understand the modern equivalent to the points that Solomon is making, the book then comes to life. God does expect a little bit of wisdom and work on our part if we're to come to truth. Truth is for those who will show themselves willing to seek the truth. Chapter 1. Solomon begins, "Vanity of vanities," says the preacher, "vanity of vanity, all is vanity." The Hebrew word here is hebel, means empty, vacuous, like the wind. And that's really biblical. As Paul writes in Romans chapter 8, that through mankind's fall into sin, the world was subject to vanity. Nothing lasts. Everything is winding down. Death permeates all creation. But the key qualifier is in verse 3, under the sun. Solomon is not saying that God and his creation is in vain, or that God is in vain. In fact, Solomon will later explain that God's world is not in vain. But as far as under the sun is concerned, as far as man unaided by divine revelation, no one can find true purpose in this life. It's all going up in flames. We're all going to die anyway. So apart from God, all you're left is with nihilism. Everything is meaningless. And that's the conclusion Solomon comes to, looking at the world under the sun without God's revelation. So the first chapter presents the problem that there are no answers under the sun, only dissatisfaction. Verse 8, all things are wearisome. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear with hearing. As in the Rolling Stones, I cannot get any satisfaction. Chapter 2, Solomon began looking for meaning in life, but he could not find it in pleasure and hedonism, nor could he find it in business and wealth, materialism. Solomon was looking for the answers under the sun, but he found none. Ecclesiastes 1:13, and I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that's done under heaven. Ecclesiastes 2:15, then I said to myself, as is the fate of the fool, it will also befall me. Why then have I been extremely wise? So I said to myself, this too is vanity. Ecclesiastes 2:17, so I hated life, for the work which had been done under the sun was grievous to me, because everything is futility and striving after wind. And we have a whole generation of people today who hate life and want to burn everything to the ground because they will not turn to God for answers, but choose to remain in vanity. So the first lesson we should glean from Ecclesiastes is the limitation of human wisdom. Solomon, in all of his wisdom, failed. There has to be more than human wisdom to find the answers and to give meaning to life. Man's wisdom cannot ultimately solve mankind's problem of sin and death. We need revelation coming from outside of ourselves to understand the world and our purpose and the end of all things. And that means we must begin with humility and teachableness. Now, there's no mention of God in Solomon's introduction. And the point is this, is where you end up without God. But when Solomon gets to chapter 2, verse 24, which should actually be a chapter division, Solomon now introduces the reader to God. And Solomon makes a statement that there can be no enjoyment, no purpose, no fulfillment in life without God. Ecclesiastes 2:24, there is nothing better for a man than to eat and drink and tell himself that his labor is good. This also I have seen, that it is from the hand of God. For who can eat and who can have enjoyment without him, without God? The point is that only God can take away the vanity of life. But for those who don't come to God, and for those who remain in their sin, they're left in vanity. Verse 26, to the person who is right with God, God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, they're left with the task of just gathering and collecting in vain. Now in chapter 3, Solomon now makes the case that rather than complaining and being bitter about this vanity, which is built into this sin-cursed world, we need to recognize that it is a good part of God's plan, that everything is appropriate. Don't go about saying that God doesn't know what he's doing. And here we have the famous Hebrew parallelism poem, Ecclesiastes 3:1. There is an appointed time for everything. There is a time for every event under heaven, a time to give birth, a time to die, a time to plant, and a time to be uprooted, what is planted, and a time to kill, and a time to heal, a time to tear down, and a time to build up. And hence we have that famous 1965 song by the Birds, Turn, Turn, Turn. But the theological point missed in that song is that everything God does, everything he allows is appropriate. All the ups and downs in life. Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verse 11. He, God, has made everything appropriate in its time. The King James Version translates it, everything is beautiful, meaning morally or ethically beautiful. Well, one might ask, how is everything appropriate? Well, the verse continues, God has also set eternity in their hearts, so yet that man will not find out the work which God has done from the beginning even to the end. This means that even though there is emptiness in this cursed world, God has set in the human heart a longing for the lasting, for the eternal. We want to live forever. And God has also made sure that we cannot fill the void or find the answers apart from him. So one might think things are really bad today, but imagine if God left us in paradise in our sin. The curse and the vanity built into this world are good because in it we see the devastation of sin and we're driven back to God. We wanted to eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and we got that knowledge. And that knowledge will drive those with pure hearts back to God. So this labor that Solomon earlier called vanity, he now says in verse 13, is a gift from God. And furthermore, verse 14, in that everything is appropriate and beautiful, nobody can make any improvements to the way God has made the world and your life. Ecclesiastes 3:14, I know that everything God does will remain forever. There is nothing to add to it, and there is nothing to take away from it, for God has so worked that men should fear him. Theologians often use the illustration of alternative universes. I mean, what if God created a world without suffering, without death, without a time to tear down and a time to build up? time to tear apart or a time to sew together. Many claim that if they were God, they would do X, Y, and Z. However, no one can come up with a better plan than God's present plan. A plan for saving souls for all eternity and establishing an everlasting kingdom of righteousness. And this brings us to the third point in Solomon's outline. Having just made the point that God's ways are perfect, he answers those who claim that they're not perfect. So point number three, the alleged contradictions or objections to God's purposes, chapter 3, verse 16, through the end of chapter 4. And the first objection is the existence of evil. It's the old, I can't believe in a good God if there's evil in the world. Ecclesiastes 3:16. Furthermore, I've seen under the sun that in the place of justice, there's wickedness, and in the place of righteousness, there is wickedness. And here, Solomon briefly gives an answer to this first complaint. Ecclesiastes 3:17, I said to myself, God will judge both the righteous man and the wicked man, for a time for every matter and for every deed is there. And Solomon's point, and really the biblical answer to evil, is that despite what it looks like now, there will be justice and God will judge. People say life is unfair, but in saying this, people are assuming that the sum total of life is just our time on earth. What if this life is only a small part of life? And what if life is eternal? Then you can't now say that life is unjust because life has just begun. You know, we experience this all the time. We go to work and there's mental and physical pain involved. And 1 minute after working, no paycheck or reward is given. And one can complain, hey, I'm not getting paid for my work. But people don't complain that way because they view the situation over weeks and months. So what if our life on earth is like a second compared to eternity? And after this second on earth, every injustice is compensated for, then life doesn't seem so unfair, does it? Now, what the critics are really saying is, I want to complain about injustice, but I really don't want God to do anything about it. Because in their heart, they know that they're actually part of that injustice. Ecclesiastes 3:17, I said to myself, God will both judge the righteous man and the wicked man, for a time, for every matter, and for every deed is there. There is a time of judgment coming, and therefore all scores will be settled. Then Solomon goes on to explain further that the delay of judgment, or rather the veiling of what God will do after we leave this earth, is a test. A test to see what people will do if they're not forced against their will to be good. Ecclesiastes 3:18, I said to myself concerning the sons of men, God has surely tested them in order for them to see that they're but beasts. And here we find this problematic text where Solomon says, you know, who knows whether there's a resurrection? Because as far as it looks on earth, we die just like animals. Men and animals both turn to dust. Who knows whether we're any different than animals? And the point is, we just don't know. That's why we need revelation from God, a revelation truth outside of ourselves. Yeah, that is, if we're to know if there's any future, any justice, or any meaning in life. Now, for the unbeliever and the atheist, their lives and their rants and their protests are meaningless. But in a very strange way, they borrow from Christianity to claim significance and purpose. But the point is that this lack of such knowledge of the afterlife or any recompense for evil is God's test to see if man will turn to God for the answers. So this is just the first objection to God's plan, the presence of evil in the world. Solomon is now going to go on to list four more objections to God's plan. He's just going to list them here in chapter 4, but then he'll provide answers in chapter 5. So here's another outline. Events that seem to contradict God's beautiful plan. Number one, the existence of evil. Number two, men who are in oppression. Number three, men who are in competition. Number 4, men who are in loneliness. And number 5, men who are in decline or replacement. So number 2, men who are oppressed. This is also a complaint about the existence of evil, but specifically the evil of social oppression. Ecclesiastes 4:1. Then I looked again at all the acts of oppression which were being done under the sun. And behold, I saw the tears of the oppressed, and that they had no one to comfort them. And on the side of their oppressor was power, but they had no one to comfort them. So I congratulated the dead who are already dead more than living, who are still living. But better off than both of them is one who has never existed, who has never seen the evil activity that's done under the sun. So the secular left today isn't coming up with anything new with their complaints about oppression and power dynamics. It's just that they try to solve the answer, or rather solve the problem, by framing the wrong question and coming up with the wrong solution. As if the problem is primarily due to racism and to Christian values they call social constructs. Their solution is to push globalism and to do away with Christian values, and then you'll really see oppression. But now again, Solomon doesn't answer this objection to God's plan until we get to chapter 5, but he just states the problem. The third alleged contradiction to the fact that God has made everything beautiful is rivalry, or what we would call today economic competition. Ecclesiastes chapter 4, verse 4, I have seen that every labor and every skill which is done is the result of rivalry between man and his neighbor. This too is vanity and striving after wind. The fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. One hand full of rest is better than two fists full of labor and striving after wind. So here Solomon is recognizing this problem with the free market. Advancement and wealth comes by trying to make things better and cheaper than your competition. You open a shop and the guy across the street opens a similar shop, and you both compete for customers, and you both lower your prices. The consumer wins, and the shop owners lose. One cannot make excessive profits in free market capitalism. Now, according to liberalism, capitalism and the free markets are bad. You know, they call capitalism a knife fight. But according to Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, free market capitalism is good. Everyone, by working in their own interests, unwillingly helps out the entire society. But the point is that in economic competition, you can't get ahead in the long term. Working to outproduce and outprice the other guy is an exercise in futility. But that's the system God has created for our good, and we have to deal with it and work within it rather than giving up or trying to overthrow it. And in this text, Solomon describes three groups, three different reactions to this problem. First, those who fold their hands. They do nothing. They're fools. Second, those who work with one hand in moderation. And third, those who overwork with greater exertion with two hands, always trying to beat their neighbor. And that too is striving after wind. Now, one might ask, why does Solomon mention economic competition as something that seems to contradict the fact that God has made everything beautiful? You know, I can understand people saying, you know, I can't believe in God because of injustice or oppression, but economic competition? Well, remember, this complaint by men and Satan and the subsequent wrong answer to the problem, communism, has resulted in the death of over 100 million people in the 20th century. And abject poverty. So we should understand why Solomon, under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, and a good reason to mention this complaint coming from critics. Now, the fourth alleged contradiction to the fact that God has made everything beautiful is people who are alone. Couples without children, people without family. And here we have that well-known passage quoted at weddings, that two are better than one. If one falls, the other can pick him up. But the complaint is, if God is love, why must some people lack human companionship and help? The fifth alleged contradiction to the fact that God has made everything beautiful is people or nations that are in decline. And Solomon writes about a king who becomes obsolete and is overthrown by an upstart. Nations rise and nations fall. As C.S. Lewis wrote, that's the key to history. Terrific energy is expended. Civilizations are built up. Excellent institutions devised. But each time something goes wrong. Some fatal flaw always brings the selfish and the cruel people to the top, and it all slides back into misery and ruin. That's what's happening in America, because people in their prosperity have abandoned God. Hard times create strong men. Strong men create good times. Good times create weak men, and weak men create hard times. And the cycle continues. But God has built this cycle into the system so that men would experience the hardships and the vanity of this fallen world and therefore seek and long for the kingdom of God and his righteousness. Now, next week, we'll move on to chapter 5, where God answers the critics. In conclusion, imagine if the young people in America, in public high schools and in public universities, would be allowed to hear and learn Ecclesiastes. The values, the worldview, the character of the next generation would be changed for good. And the leftist immorality and the leftist Marxism would not be able to get such a foothold, because the entrance of God's word gives light. It gives understanding to the simple. Thanks for listening. Subscribe, like, share, leave a comment below, and may Jesus Christ reign.